take a seat so we can get started on our item G, an educational agenda. I think before we introduce this very exciting program, and I want to thank ahead of time all of the presenters. I know, as I said before, I think you'll be mobbed before you leave, so I wanted to make sure that you know how much I greatly appreciate you lending your expertise and presenting at this important educational session. I wanted to say first some introductory remarks about criminal justice realignment and why we find ourselves here today. As many of you know, this represents one of the most fundamental shifts in California's criminal justice policy in recent years. And, as we know, every element of local justice systems has been impacted. Judges are implementing a complex new sentencing framework, and our courts have been charged with significant new responsibilities. At our December Judicial Council meeting, several council members expressed an interest in having an educational presentation on criminal justice realignment, the process, the issues, and the real-life experiences that are happening in the courts and on the streets. Many courts, as you know, are spearheading innovative county-level programs that have been tailored to meet local needs. They are also tailored to reduce recidivism, to protect public safety, all of those without compromising judicial discretion or integrity. And as we heard at our December council meeting, these changes have not come easily, and some judges are discouraged by how some elements of realignment are unfolding, particularly the effect on jail overcrowding. Judges have reported that defendants appearing before them with new charges before they should have been released from custody on their original sentence. We need to support our local and state partners as they tackle these issues. When developing positions on legislation and budget proposals, we need to put proposals in the context of broader realignment goals. And as we think about the impact of proposals on the branch, we must also think about improving public safety and offender outcomes. We need to support programs and practices known to reduce recidivism because all of us want fewer victims. Historically, the courts have been leaders in innovation, establishing collaborative court models. Many of us here at council and in the audience have created and presided over these collaborative courts, including our administrative director when he was a judge. These courts have at their center the very solutions that can make realignment a success. The legislature is now looking to expand these models, these collaborative courts, and our branch's experience with collaborative courts can assist in appropriately utilizing these courts to deliver appropriate realignment outcomes. And today we'll have a comprehensive series of panels on criminal justice realignment, providing a broad overview as well as practical implementation experiences from courts and justice system partners. I thank all the panelists for being here. We have five distinct presentations on this educational item. There are no materials and no action is required. And we welcome Judge Cousins and Presiding Justice Bigelow, who've helped the courts immensely with training and education on criminal realignment, to begin here today, this presentation, with an introduction and background on criminal justice realignment. Welcome.
Thank you, Chief Justice and members of the council. It's my pleasure to be here to give you this kind of update on what's happened with realignment in the courts over this last 2 years. I want to introduce you to the packet that we have given you. If you've had an opportunity to look at it, you will see our PowerPoint, a brief PowerPoint for you. We have an overview and fact sheet with sort of a summary of the very basics of justice realignment. You could probably read that to the kids and they'll understand that. We have also a comprehensive FAQ packet that has been worked on over the years to answer most of the kind of the nitty-gritty little legal questions. There's also some statistics that will tell you how things are happening in the courts and so forth. CPOC has an issue brief, and then there's some information on the Ventura model that you will hear about a little later on. If you have questions, we'd be happy to try to respond to them. So I know you're not reticent or shy about that, so feel free to jump in as you like. We thought it might be helpful at this juncture, for particularly since many of you perhaps are not from the criminal arena, to have just a very brief primer on what realignment did and how it had accomplished it. As you know, there was a U.S. Supreme Court decision that said California had to dump a bunch of prisoners out of custody, or the federal judges were going to do that for us. So in response to that, realignment was created. Under the traditional sentencing process, if there was a conviction, a court could put a person on probation, and if there was time to be served, it'd be served in jail. Or you could send them directly to state prison, not pass go, not get the $200, and you would serve the time in state prison. After the state prison, everybody would serve a period of parole, usually no less than about 3 years, and that was supervised by the parole authorities. Well, this was how they accomplished the population shift. They divided the process basically into two main segments. There's the now a new process called an 1170H commitment, where sentences go to jail. It works pretty much the same as the old system, but obviously you can see a dramatic result in where people are housed. So with a conviction, you can put a person on probation with jail time, or you can make a direct commitment to jail under Section 1170H, and Trish will talk a little bit about what that means. Then the court has an opportunity at that point, when the person goes to jail, to decide between two basic sentencing systems. One is to give a straight term. In that situation, the person will serve time in jail and complete the sentence and be out. And the other option is to split that sentence, part in custody, part on supervision. Again, if there's any jail time, it would be there locally. But they made the decision not to have any parole after that. Once that sentence is served, the person walks out with no supervision at all. The other track was for crimes that were, for whatever reason, were reserved for state prison. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. With the conviction, of course, many are probation eligible with jail commitments, or you can commit directly to state prison. Then when the person is ready to get out of state prison, again, the system divides into two phases. The less serious offenders are put on what's called PRCS, or post-release community supervision. This is a process where the person is served, supervised by probation. If there are violations, they serve time in jail. The other group, the more serious group, remains on parole. As under the old system, they are supervised by parole. But if there are violations, in most situations, the time is served in county jail. In a few instances, they're referred back to prison. Now you can see how much we see now jail as a part of the component and local probation services that did not exist previously. And that sets up these concerns that you're going to hear about today. I'm going to ask Trish now to explain just the basic sentencing process.
Chief, honorable members of the council. To look at realignment, I think the backdrop would be to say that it appears that the governor's office went through all of our statutes and looked at everything that provides for a criminal penalty, not just in the penal code, but also in the welfare and institution codes, the business and professions codes, in the fish and game codes, and reviewed all of the sentences and placed them into basically two piles. Those, the vast majority of which, will now go to county jail, and those which will retain a state prison sentence. And while there are those two piles, I think it's best to understand how realignment works to think of it actually in three groups, as is on the PowerPoint there. And the first group is the vast majority of crimes, as I indicated, and those are the crimes that have been realigned from state prison to county jail. They are comprised largely of wobblers, crimes that we're familiar with in the penal code where the designated penalty was not stated. It was simply county jail or to state prison and would default into a 16-month, 2-year, or 3-year sentence. In addition, what's been added also as those crimes that will head to county jail instead of state prison are a great number of crimes, things like second-degree burglary, auto theft, the vast majority of drug crimes and property offenses. Those are all going to now be housed. Those persons will be housed in county jail, and their terms remain the same. They are retaining approximately 80 crimes which still go to state prison. These are the more serious crimes that still go there. And the third group is an exclusion. So those persons who are now to go to county jail under realignment, but will, because of their background or their crime that they've committed, instead be housed in state prison, even though they would normally now be realigned to county jail. Those exclusions are for persons who have currently or previously been convicted of a serious or violent crime. Those who are required to register as sex offenders. In addition, those who have been convicted of an enhancement under 186.11 for aggravated theft in an amount over approximately $100,000. So I think if you keep that purview in mind of where everything's going, it's helpful to an understanding of realignment. In making these changes, it's nice to know that there are some things that haven't changed, things that judges can hold on to and say, hey, I know those Byzantine rules that apply to state prison and computing sentences, and some of those remain, and some have changed. But let's talk about what hasn't changed. Realignment does not change eligibility for probation. And it's good to keep in mind that, in fact, realignment does not even come into effect until the trial judge has made a decision to deny probation. So in every instance, the court still may grant probation. After a judge decides that, that's when realignment comes into effect. Alternative sentencings are still available. Deferred entry of judgment, DEJ, diversion, I should say. In addition, another thing that we can hold on to is the fact that the computation of these crimes remain the same. Under 1170.1 and 1170, the rules with regards to concurrent and consecutive sentencing, the addition of both conduct and status enhancements remain the same, so we again have judges something that they can hold on to as familiar to them in that area. There is no change in the custody terms, and to give you an idea of the population that is housed in county jail now, the crimes, they can be very lengthy. The longest one we have found is a violation of Welfare and Institution Code Section 13387, which is discharging certain pollutants, which can result in a term in county jail of 10, 20, and 30 years. It's a broad array of those housed there. The other things that have changed, of course, is the place where they're housed, but in addition, as Richard discussed, the fact that there is no parole, no supervision after the sentence is served. Using realignment, there are certain sentencing choices that a judge makes to determine where or how they should serve their sentence. The sentencing choice first is one that we're very familiar with, one that we normally use. It's computed in the traditional manner, except that the service is in county jail. It is subject to early release by the sheriff when there's overcrowding problems. A defendant incarcerated pursuant to an 1170H crime will receive half-time credits. Again, there's no supervision when they are released. The newer model that is the subject of many rules, discussions, legislative proposals, and has been something that we're working with in the trial courts is what's called a split sentence, split or blended sentence. And I think the best way to envision this is to think of a sentenced prisoner, someone going to county jail, serves part of the time traditionally in custody, and the other half of that time on what's called mandatory supervision. It looks like probation, it talks like probation, and it feels like probation, but it's mandatory. It's mandatory, and I'm going to talk about that. Again, the term is computed in the traditional manner. We hang on to that. The custody period, that first period where the person is incarcerated, the defendant receives half-time credit. The concluding portion of that term, so a person would be sentenced, you compute the aggregate term and indicate, I would like 1 year of that to be served in county jail, the remaining term to be served on mandatory supervision. That is discretionary choice by the court to determine whether or not mandatory supervision is appropriate. It is up to the discretion of court to make that choice, to determine the length of that period that should be served on mandatory supervision and the terms that will be served. At this point, a defendant gets only actual credits when they're on a mandatory supervision period. If there is a violation, it is remanded, the defendant can be remanded to serve the remaining time. It's called mandatory supervision, and here's where it differs from probation. When a defendant is placed on probation, we commonly ask, and we're required to ask, do you understand and agree to accept the terms and conditions of probation? Well, with mandatory supervision, we don't have to ask that. It is mandatory. They must do it. And during that period of time, yes, sir.
I don't think that's accurate. I think on mandatory supervision, we ask them because they can refuse it, and then they just serve their time.
No, I'm sorry. That's not true. It's mandatory, and that's why it's called that. It must serve the time.
Respectfully, Dave, you're wrong.
Leave it to Richard to say that. Thank you.
In other words,
add your overrule.
If they refuse mandatory supervision, they don't get it. They get straight sentence.
No. They announced they're going to violate. And
well, in our court, we have them sign an agreement.
We have 58 different counties.
Nice?
Each one does it their own way.
You don't have to be that nice, Dave.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you learn.
I think the point has been made. I think the point has been made. And given our time frame, I'm going to ask you, Justice Bigelow, to please continue.
I will. Okay. There is no supervision when it's completed. And thank you so much for your time on this aspect.
As indicated, we've also changed some of the processes for dealing with people as they come out of prison. The first is PRCS that I mentioned earlier, supervised by probation. If the violation occurs, probation is supposed to intervene at some informal levels. First, try intermediate sanctions, including this concept called flash incarceration, where the probation officer can order up to 10 days in custody, and they serve that in jail. If that doesn't work, then if they can bring a petition to the court, and we can impose up to 6 months for each violation, but they do get half-time credit. We cannot send any of these people back to prison unless they commit a new crime that warrants state prison. The other more serious offenders are back on parole. It works very much the same, except now this is supervised by the parole authorities. But the court shares the responsibility in adjudicating the violations. We have kind of shared responsibility. Again, parole has this duty to impose intermediate sanctions, including the flash incarceration. And again, if that doesn't work, the court can impose custody of up to 6 months. In most situations, again, we cannot send the person back to prison. There's a very limited group we can, or for murder or for some aggravated sex crimes, we can do that. Otherwise, they stay with us. So you can see there's a huge shift now to the population, not only physically, but in supervision to the counties. We'd like now to turn to the panels to talk about the effect of this from a state perspective in terms of the agencies that are going to speak to you, but they will address the local concerns and how that has been addressed. So I'd like the first panel to come up, please. And I'd like to introduce to you the group that will talk about what's happening locally. We'll talk about the local perspectives. After that, we'll have the Judicial Council Advisory Committees talk about what's going on there. We have some wonderful programs that we want to brief you on in terms of what the courts are doing, and then we'll wrap up. So our first group is Linda Penner. She's chair of the board of the State and Community Corrections. Elizabeth Howard Espinoza, who is a legislative advocate for CSAC. Nick Warner, policy director for the State Sheriff's Association, and Karen Pank, who is the executive director of CPOC. So we'll start with Linda.
Thank you. May I remain seated,
please,
Your
remain
Honor?
Seated.
Thank you. Judge Cousin asked me to be superficial in my remarks. And because that is personally a gift of mine, I shall proceed in that fashion. I actually am a wobbler. I am a state employee at this juncture. I came to the state actually dragging my heels down Highway 99 after I retired from my job as the chief probation officer in Fresno County. When I retired, the governor, who was heavily invested in realignment and really has stayed invested in realignment, asked me to come to work to represent certainly the state's efforts on realignment, but then to keep the locals in the mind of the state while I was in Sacramento. And since that time, I wasn't interested in moving to Sacramento, but I, because the governor's a better negotiator than I took the job, and I'm currently residing in Sacramento a fair amount of the time. I did that because I was the president of the chief probation officers at the time realignment was going into play, and I felt strongly about certainly the dilemma we were faced with in terms of the three-judge panel and the reduction of the population in the prison system. And when I was a probation officer, felt that agenda needed to be moved and it had to be done strategically and with a great deal of input from the stakeholders. And my rationale from coming to the state is because I think that was still important to maintain. I say all that not because I want to talk about myself a lot, but because I think it's important for the courts to understand that the genesis of realignment was one that certainly was a state shift and a state law and policy changes at the state level, but it involved these stakeholders all through the process. It did it pre-realignment, and it has continued to do that post-realignment. I tell you that because the people you see sitting at this dais right now are people that continue to meet monthly, sometimes bi-monthly, to talk about the issues that we face, reckoning with the fact that realignment is not a perfect law, and no one may speak at this point, that it has matters that need to be addressed, that it has policies that need to be tweaked and enhanced. But we're trying to do that in a very strategic manner. That is, not to begin to take apart a law before we can see that the rollout has various impacts. And so this year in the budget, we've tackled three specific items, and I want to raise those. One is the long-term sentences, and I heard some reference to that in the previous presentation. Certainly, we all know county jails, and it is the state of California has an infrastructure that is very old in terms of their county jails, and it is not was not built for long-term sentences. In this budget, in January, the governor proposed an additional $500 million in what we call 1022 money. 1022 money is money that is jail space that has programming associated with it. And so we now, the state is in, will have invested, should this go forward, $1 billion in program space in county jails. I can tell you the sheriffs in the state of California, and Nick Warner will address this, are incredibly interested in this piece of policy. Beyond that, you will see additional caveat wherein there is the presumption of the split that is recommended. And we have watched the rollout of realignment and feel strongly that the split sentence is imperative. And certainly because I am from the probation discipline, I feel strongly about the fact that there should be a period of supervision. There should be a period where we have an ability to enhance treatment and whatever efforts need to be made while an individual's in the community. And beyond that, I think there are some public safety issues that are addressed by the split sentence. The work I have done since I've been in Sacramento has a lot to do with work outside of Sacramento. One-on-one, the governor and myself and often Diane Cummings have visited county after county after county, and those are conversations that occur in a closed room where there can be frank conversation and discussion about the needs of the realignment impacted departments and programs. And we're learning bit by bit what needs to be done. I'm certainly aware of the need to change, but I'm pleased with the fact that we haven't jumped the gun and began to take it apart piece by piece. With that, you know, I think I should lend the rest. I only got 5 or 6 minutes to be superficial, so I didn't get to say much. But I'm going to give up some of my time and move on.
Let's get the CSACs protecting you.
Thank you. I will attempt to be very profound with you today. thank you for having me, Chief Justice and honorable members of the council and Judge Darr. We're, of course, happy to be here. CSAC and the Judicial Council and the AOC have a long history of partnership, and I think that is a theme you will hear throughout our discussion today, that collaboration and partnership are what it's going to take to make realignment work, not only from a statewide policy perspective, but at the local level as well. So just very briefly, CSAC, of course, is the Association of Counties. We represent the 58 County Boards of Supervisors. You all likely have relationships with your Board of Supervisors at the local level. And our, as sort of obvious as it may sound, our primary objective with realignment is to make sure counties have the tools and the resources that they need to be successful with implementation of AB 109 over the long term. I think the arc of activity right now at the local level is we are moving from the triage phase and going towards, okay, what do we need for the long term? We're, we have managed, you know, successfully. I think counties are resilient. Government in general is resilient. And we have managed thus far with really what represented a significant wave of responsibility coming into county jurisdiction. And now we're able to look up and say, okay, we've made it this far, but what do we need over the long term? So as Linda said, we're constantly evaluating what we have now and what we might need in the future to make sure we're successful. So I wanted to talk to you about three specific things that we're working on. One of them often gets a lot of attention, and it has to do with the allocation of funds. I will just spend a few minutes on this. We could certainly talk about this all day, but I want you to understand what CSAC's role is when it comes to the financing of realignment. And there are several aspects to it. Department of Finance, when they were putting together their estimates about workload and what they thought that they could afford to give counties to carry out these very significant reforms at the local level, established the bid pot. So they define how much money comes out to counties on an annual basis. CSAC, our association, has a specific role in, and I know you all wish you had this responsibility, is deciding how to divide that money up among the 58 counties. Very hard work. We have a group of 9 county administrative officers that are charged with doing that work. They're currently working on a new formula that will go into effect in the coming fiscal year, but trying to make sure that counties who started realignment from very different places, there was a, you know, you understand this from the trial court level, there is, you know, some counties and some courts are differently resourced or historically have been differently resourced, and how do you, I know you've grappled with this yourselves as a branch, but how do you make sure that you can get money out to the 58 counties to ensure they can be successful over the long term? So we are currently working on that, and that will continue to be a focus. Once the money gets out to the counties, one of the premises of realignment was we are taking on a responsibility and we are being given resources to do that. But once it gets to the county level, there is a multi-agency process. It's a process chaired by the probation chief that actually dates back to SB 678 that we know the courts are understand and are involved in and supportive of. Those decisions are made locally, and we think that's how it should work. We don't sit in judgment in terms of how counties make these decisions. We trust the responsible officials who understand the needs and the gaps and the service capacity to make those decisions locally. So I just wanted to spend a few minutes talking about that. And then the two other pieces are really much bigger picture and perhaps even harder than doing the allocation is providing the leadership and training to support county capacity over the long term. We're very grateful that the administration and the legislature saw fit to provide some additional resources outside of the programmatic money to fund training. I think they recognized realignment represents a very significant, we'll hear this over and over, very significant, you know, the biggest criminal justice reform in our generation, but it's true. And so they understood that you have to provide training to not only see the change, but to support the change, the leadership change, the system changes over the long term. So we've worked collaboratively, our three associations on this side of the table, to put together statewide conferences, 1 and 2 day trainings that many of your colleagues at the local level from the bench have participated in as people in the audience, but also speakers. There is a lot that we can learn from each other, and we wanted to acknowledge and thank you for the leadership from the local benches in helping to talk about what are the best practices, what's working, what's not working, where do we need to, you know, sort of change our tack. So I wanted to appreciate that, but we're working on a continuous basis to deliver good training and education to support this over the long term. And then finally, the CSAC role is a little bit different than the subject matter specific roles, which are extraordinarily important, but we also are trying to look at realignment from the biggest picture and seeing what door are these populations coming in, and are there better ways to leverage not only realignment resources, but other resources. If we're touching a family on the child welfare side or on the foster care side or on some other side, is there a way for us to make sure we're wrapping that family up in other resources that might be available to us? An example where we spend a lot of time is making sure that counties understand not only the opportunities, but what they need to do to benefit from the opportunities under the Affordable Care Act. Lots and lots of people who previously did not have coverage, health coverage, are eligible as of January 1, and so we have to put systems in place at the local level to make sure we can benefit from that, because we see that as a building block, a way to provide stability to families that may have be involved in the criminal justice system, and you know, part of the way that you can help that community reintegration and success over the long term. So those are the things I wanted to hit on, and I know my colleagues have lots of other good things to say.
Nick Warner, your association folks house all these folks, so what's your take on this?
First of all, I just want to say thank you to the chief and your colleagues for having me here. I speak professionally to esteemed bodies in the legislature and beyond, and I'd be lying if I said I wasn't a little bit nervous and intimidated, but also really, really honored to be here. It's a high point in my career, and I really, really appreciate the invitation, and I just want to say that. So how did we get here from a sheriff's perspective? How did we get here maybe from a state perspective? Realignment's rooted in overcrowding. It's rooted in probably decades of underattention to facilities and to proper space in a growing state and a vibrant state. It's rooted in budgetary meltdown of epic proportions at the state level, and it's also rooted in some good public policy, which is that locals could probably do a better job than the state in a lot of these cases. So that's the root of how we got here. It's put tremendous strain, to answer your question, tremendous strain on the jail system. Tremendous strain, and it shouldn't be underattended to by this body. It shouldn't be, although at times I think that it is unquestionably underattended to in the legislature. It's put tremendous strain on the county jail system, and I'll give you some quantifiables to go with that. I will say to Chief Penner, to Linda Penner's point, the administration has and continues to take extraordinary care in the way they are working with locals, not just the visits, but the manner and style of listening, the frequency of the meetings, the action end and trailer bills and legislation that comes from this governor. This is a really intricate, important sea change. You know, I'm telling you as if you don't know, but it's acute in county sheriff land. It's acute in county land. And the administration's taking it seriously. And that's one of the things that is key in the executive branch, to have a good partner who really understands, not just at the elected level, but at the staff level, that this is a big deal for everybody. And this has got to go well. And we're not done. We get asked questions in the media and the legislature, did realignment work? I would suggest to you that that's not a savvy question. That's an ill-informed question. It's somewhere in between here and there. The people that say that it's been a dismal failure are patently wrong. People that say it's been a smashing success are, at least in my humble opinion, wrong. It's somewhere in between here and there, and we're dedicated to, as evidenced by being here, and I think a lot of the work that goes in from the executive, the judicial, and local government branch, dedicated to making it work and making it work better. I say, and this may be the wrong place to be sarcastic, but in a particularly difficult moment, one of the sheriffs pulled me aside and he said, "Hey, Nick, what are we going to do? Screw it up worse than the state?" So some of that is rooted in, we think we can do this, but we have to be properly resourced in order to do this. So jail facilities were and still are, by and large, ill-equipped to deal with the number and the types of inmates that we're receiving. Let me just give you some facts to go with that. This is from the BSCC's data. Realignment has increased jail population by 11,000 inmates, which puts us 11,500 over the rated capacity statewide. We're releasing, and this is from the first half of 2013, 13,000 inmates per month early. So we're essentially making decisions on a daily basis which inmates to release early. We're releasing the best of the worst. We also came into this with varying degrees of capacity, both literally and academically, in counties. We had some counties that were in advance of this power curve. We had some counties that were not. We had some counties that were experiencing really dramatic population increases that were in difficult positions before realignment hit, before we agreed, frankly, the concept of realignment. So counties, when you talk about the county plight, there isn't one answer. There's a lot of different and varying degrees to which counties had the capacity to handle this. 30 counties were under population or are under court-imposed population caps. So it's essentially one in, one out. And that's a really difficult dynamic, as you might imagine, and you're just past year two. So to the note that Linda Petter made and Elizabeth touched on it also, the SB 1022 funding, which is essentially jail funding, it's critically important, but it's also not being processed correctly in the state capitol, and that's part of our charge, as part of our ongoing education process. We don't want to simply warehouse people. We get the point. I played the sheriffs back to the sheriffs recently at a roundtable meeting. I said, six of you said the term evidence-based programming. All of you are talking about mental health. The vast majority of you have mentioned treatment, education, and rehabilitation in some form or fashion. I couldn't be any more proud of the sheriffs of the state of California, but they don't all have the capacity, the physical capacity, to do the things we want to do. We have jail facilities up and down the state, some that are great. I'm not saying I'd want to live there, but they're great in the fact that we have vocational and educational space. We have yard space. We have programs. We have health bays where we can treat people's symptoms. But we have jails in this state. This is a human being issue. This is not an inmate issue, a sheriff issue. This is a human being issue where we have no ambient light, no treatment space, no classroom space, nowhere to treat these people for the things that we're being asked to treat them for. And we're committed to doing the things that the legislature, the governor, envision us doing, but we're not there. In a lot of counties, we're not even close to there yet. So, yeah, we are arguing for an additional $500 million on top of $500 million last year to improve conditions in these jails so we can do the things that we want to do. Some additional notes that I think are interesting and problematic. We almost completed a survey, but you know how many surveys you get from the AOC. The sheriffs get that many from state sheriff associations. So we have 40 counties that have reported, and we have just under 2,000 inmates that have been sentenced so far under realignment, just under 2,000 inmates that have been sentenced to between 5 and 10 years in county jail. The average length of stay was approximately 66 days prior to realignment. We have about 2,000 that have been sentenced to between 5 and 10 years. My analogy is, Nick, did you like your stay at the Ramada Inn? Yeah, it was great. Would you like to stay there for 5 years? No. We are not equipped to handle these people for this long at this period of time, and that's what this money is so critically important for. We have just under 200 inmates that have been sentenced to more than 10 years in county jail. Sentenced to more than 10 years in county jail. So, I mean, the folks in this room understand how problematic that is, especially given our current state, so I won't go too much further into that. Challenges and needs. Mental health care, these create ADA issues, Americans with Disability Act issues, as you might imagine. So we're desperately working to improve, renovate, expand, modernize our facilities to decrease our overall liability and also to the human condition to do a better job with people that are behind bars who, as we all know, are going to get out. We'd like to send them out in a better state than we got them. I think sheriffs are managing the crisis pretty well. But make no mistake, in a lot of counties, it is a crisis. It's not unmanageable. The executive acumen of the men and women that are running sheriff's departments these days is really high. They're very committed. Are they having trouble? Yes. Does it come out in ways that at times they and we and the governor wish it didn't? Yeah. But they're dedicated to this. We supported the concept of realignment. We continue to support the concept of realignment. But to be real with you and the legislature, it's difficult, and there are public safety implications now and ongoing. So with that, I'll turn it over to...
Yeah, Karen Pank, now you're getting the brunt of the supervision responsibilities here. How has your agency responded to that?
Thank you very much, Judge Cousins, and thank you, Chief, and honorable members for also inviting me here today. The chiefs, the probation chiefs who I represent, I know speak highly of many of you who they get to work with each day, and they appreciate having the opportunity to kind of share on a global perspective what they are experiencing with realignment and hopefully engage in a little bit of discussion related to that. I agreed to go last because you told me that way no one could rebut what I had to say, correct? Isn't that how that works? Okay, well, maybe not so much, but we're going to try that. So we were asked to talk a little bit about why did CPOC as an organization support realignment? What did we, because we did end up coming out in support of realignment at the time. And looking at now several years into it, there are a lot of challenges and a lot of opportunities. opportunities, and that is in part why we considered it at the time. Of course, as it was already outlined, the alternative was untenable from a public safety perspective, so that kind of made the choice a little bit easier, perhaps. But we also wanted to look at something that the Chief Justice mentioned in our opening comments, and that was improving outcomes. It sounds academic, you know, on paper, but what that means is stopping the revolving door, and with the revolving door comes through another victim. And we saw this in our everyday work. You see it in your everyday work, and it was something very important and things that we have been working on from a policy perspective for years leading up to realignment. And so there were some potential opportunities to try to improve the system and frankly look at redistributing resources, scarce resources, to an area within the system that we thought had been grossly underfunded for many, many years. So that's one of the reasons why we thought some of the things related to realignment, some of those changes, could potentially have better outcomes for California. And it started prior to realignment, and I think it was already mentioned by an earlier speaker, the support of SB 678. So in a way, I feel like probation had a little bit of a head start with what became this tidal wave of realignment. And I would say just a little bit of a head start, because those of you who are familiar with that, that it was a small amount of money, but we made a big impact with it, and it was an opportunity to start doing things differently on our probation caseload with offenders that were coming to us anyways and trying to put evidence-based practices to work. In doing so, in 2010, so this is before realignment, we were able to drop probation failures by 23%. Again, sounds very academic, but those probation failures usually result in victims and in an impact to our state at a very costly resource. Again, going back to those scarce resources, they would be going back to state prison, and in many cases, that's what's needed, and we certainly wouldn't want to stop that, but we know there's not enough room going back to the overcrowded. So how do we efficiently protect our communities and change these outcomes and use what we do have with the folks who need to be in those incarcerated settings? So all of those things were happening prior to realignment. I think when you really look in some of the wording of realignment in the statutes, you will see it's very similar to what we wrote related to 678, the types of kind of the hopes, the dreams of what we would like to accomplish. But, you know, we were also asked to talk about, you know, is it working? If it is, or is certain parts of it working? I think that's the difficulty, right? When you kind of take it from the academic and then go into the practical world, how is this rolling out? It's different in 58 different counties, in all of the different courtrooms even. I mean, I think you can go down to that level. It's not even just the differences in the counties, but differences in how you are dealing with what you have available to you. And that's, you know, we are seeing some, I would say, successes. We're seeing improved outcomes with very dedicated caseloads that probation is working with in many cases. Most of the time it's working because of collaboration. And I think that was also mentioned earlier. It's so key and important to the process. But what does that mean? It manifests in the CCP, the Community Corrections Partnership, that was charged with trying to develop some of the policies that we would put into place locally to deal with realignment. And, you know, I would just make a pitch and encourage many of you, I think, probably are involved in some level with that local planning process, whether it's formally or informally. But the court's role is so significant to that, because if it's not somehow worked into how we are addressing realignment in each of our counties, that bifurcation creates just – a different type of revolving door. And what I mean by that is, if you've listened to the previous speakers, you know we already have overcrowding at the local level, as you're all familiar with, in our bricks and mortar, but we're also overcrowded with human infrastructure, right? Our caseloads on the probation side are very high, and in many counties higher than others. And so you need to kind of think through, well, how is realignment going to be impacting that? So if you look at some of the flow charts that you had gone over, Judge Cousins, earlier, and you see the decisions that you're able to make and that come before you in your courtroom, and if those are limited to kind of the way you may have done things before realignment, you make the sentence and you say, well, this person was previously going to state prison for X amount of time. Now they will go serve their time in county jail, and think that is it. I think you probably all at some point in time have some frustration with that, because that's not what it doesn't end there, right? They many times will not spend that whole amount of time in county jail. And realignment has given the sheriffs some tools that they need to use to manage that population. The collaboration that takes place, hopefully, in the counties within the CCP and in other opportunities will also look at, well, how are we going to protect public safety if we're not going to necessarily have them for the whole amount of time in county jail? Those are things that I think would be very important to the court system to understand as you look at the people who come before you. So we see it working better, I would say, in counties where that collaboration exists, and collaboration with the courts is very important. So, again, where are the problems? Obviously, where there isn't those kinds of communication, that type of collaboration, it is difficult. Obviously, the overcrowding issue, the high caseloads are problematic. And it is true, you hear from the news, and you probably see it every day in the courts, that some of these folks coming through are maybe a little more hardened, do have more significant needs than what we saw with felony probation. But for the most part, there is a playbook that I think probation is familiar enough with, that with the appropriate resources, and if we build out those tools, we'll be able to address some of those things.
I think we need to kind of move into our next area at this point. Are there any questions of this group before we move on? Yes. Marianne?
This was for Mr. Warner and Ms. Penner. You talked about the $1 billion and 1022 for program space. So is that reconfiguring current jails, building new ones, developing out-of-custody supervision programs like electronic home detention, I mean, other ways for people to serve their sentence, or what exactly, what are examples of what program space is?
I'm glad you asked that, because I'd like an opportunity to expand on that. What we know in visiting the jails that are currently in play, they're many of the jails, I was in L.A. 2 weeks ago, have no room to do anything that resembles a place where you could have an educational program or have a treatment program or even a group program. We were in the special needs portion of the jail. It was 240 individuals on triple stacked bunks that, I didn't see much room to do much there that would enhance programming. So all of the things that you mentioned could be part of a 1022 sort of award. What we saw is programs that were in custody that would then bridge to out of custody, where you might partner with your probation department and move somebody that's in a treatment or an educational program systematically through the system and out the door for a soft landing, lack of a better way to say it. There were 36 counties that applied, and so you saw a little bit of everything when you did that. There has been a discussion that's talking about, are you just building new beds, or are you building infrastructure or replacement beds? We saw a little bit of everything. And some of that is just smart money, the way I see it. for instance, hearkening from Fresno, they didn't have a footprint for another facility in Fresno to build a jail. So they're gutting one and reinventing the space within. Other counties had a master plan that will allow them to go out and have a footprint for a jail where they're not going to have NIMBY issues and the kinds of problems you have putting up a jail, and they're going to be able to build a facility to program specifically. And we've seen a lot of great program facilities up. Stanislaus County has one that to beat the band. There are a number of those that are ongoing.
Thank you.
Dick?
Yes, Harry?
Yeah. Thank you. I'm finding this very informative, and I appreciate the time. I know we all do, not only the time you're with us today, but the time you spend getting ready to be with us today, and I appreciate that a great deal. Judge O'Malley anticipated most of my question, which is not surprising because Judge O'Malley is usually ahead of me on these things. But on the money and as it's being spent, obviously, if it's allocated, it'll be spent on facilities in part, but I assume the money also will be spent on personnel and mental health, expansion of mental health programs and all those matters.
Well, can I'm so talkative. Let me say this. The CCP, of course, county by county allocates the money, and there has been a fair amount of criticism, and I heard this even coming into this presentation today, that the sheriffs are taking the lion's share of the money. And I would probably counter that by saying there were great needs. The state had been through a dramatic economic downturn. A number of jail beds had been shut down. And so to begin the purpose of realignment, there were some things that had to be rebuilt and brought back up to such a place that we then could begin to roll out the meaningful programs that should be associated with this. It has been none too slow. Realignment has been painfully slow. When you take a state process and overlay it on county land, just moving out RFPs and being able to roll out the contracts associated with these kinds of endeavors takes a great deal of time. We're seeing now, we're not hearing about sheriffs getting all the money, but programs rolling and sheriffs rolling programs out in partnership with the other stakeholders. So we were a bit broken when this occurred. The state certainly had an enormous problem. The county took on the workload, and the rollout has not been painless.
Thank you. Yes.
Regarding the SB 1022 money, is there a county match obligation here?
And yeah. You're rolling.
Okay, I don't want to talk anymore. You can't set me up, Dean. It's not right.
Good to see you again.
Yeah, thanks. Good to see you. Yes, there is. It's minimal, and we haven't had some of it's a soft match,
yeah,
I believe.
Well, just so quick history on it, really quick history, I promise, Judge Cushions. It was 25% in AB 900, which was kind of the little brother, little sister to SB 1022, and it was such a big barrier to entry for counties. They could not come up with a match to make it. So the state dropped it to 10%, and they also allow a soft match, which accounts for land primarily and some staff time. But the 10% match has been much more attainable for the counties, and so I think that's a good balance.
And the elephant in the room is these are public works bonds, so it's not fast money. Let me say that. It has, oh, my goodness, it has a process with it that makes – the appellate courts look simple. How's that? So it is.
Well, I'm glad you said simple and not fast.
Simple, yeah. And I didn't say slow.
Thank you very much, panel members. And we'll have the next group come up. The council, of course, has some very active committees that advise you on a variety of issues that touch on realignment. And we thought it'd be useful for the chairs of these groups to talk to you about what's happening in their respective groups, some of the legislation they're reviewing and projects they're working on to facilitate realignment. We have Trish Bigelow, the chair of the Criminal Law Advisory Committee, Morris Jacobson, a member of your body, who is your liaison to the Criminal Justice Services Office with Shelley Curran, Rick Lavianos, who is the chair of the Collaborative Justice Courts Advisory Committee, and finally Brian Walsh, who is chair of the presiding judges. So we'll start with Trish.
Hello again. The charge of the Criminal Law Advisory Committee, pursuant to the rules of court, is to make recommendations to the council for the administration of justice and criminal proceedings. Our membership must include one of each of the following: an appellate court justice, a trial court judicial officer, a prosecutor, a defense attorney, a judicial administrator, and a probation officer. We enjoy a broad diversity of those members with a great depth of experience in what they do. They work hard, and we always maintain a spirit of collegiality and collaboration. With the advent of realignment, I'm honored to be at the helm of such a dedicated group whose members regularly and often weekly meet to take their time and busy schedules to serve this council and develop recommendations for assisting our trial courts and during this sea change in sentencing. From the outset, the committee has worked to make recommendations to change forms, rules, and to make legislative proposals, all of them with a singularly focused to facilitate trial court implementation with ease in this new area of realignment. I'd like to give you a few examples in each of those areas, forms, rules, and legislative proposals. In the forms arena, to facilitate the new probation revocation proceedings, particularly now that we are interacting with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, the committee developed forms for the courts to use to initiate the revocation process, to request warrants to revoke, and to recall those warrants. In the arena of rules, to ensure that the courts receive the appropriate information from supervising agencies to adjudicate these revocations, the committee developed a new rule which determines what is necessary for a trial court judge to make an appropriate determination, what's going to be sufficient, what we need to consider. In the legislative proposal area, one of the things we're really most proud of is that we have worked to promote the uniformity and minimize the impacts of dealing with these new forms of supervision, both mandatory supervision, post-release community supervision, and parole. And in doing so, we've applied the long-standing and, again, familiar procedures to trial court judges that are applicable to probation revocation. So applying new rules is not what we need to do. We're using old rules and new principles. Shortly after our proposal was approved for judicial council sponsorship, the governor's office took up the heart of the bill and swiftly passed it by means of a budget trailer bill. In the legislative arena, the committee regularly reviews pending law legislation to identify court impacts, raise concerns, and offer suggestions for improvement as to proposed bills. And we recommend to the judicial council the positions that we believe are appropriate. In sum, there really has not been a shortage of work at all for the committee in this unprecedented and unending procedural uncertainties brought about by realignment. Our work continues right now in response to concerns voiced about prolonged delays and over-detention of parolees. The committee has developed a legislative proposal to prescribe 5-day time limits before the supervising agency needs to bring that before the court, and to also eliminate any uncertainty about the fact that the trial judge is the one who has the final say on where their housing will be. We will be allowed to put them out of custody if they think, or keep them there. We have this proposal and 6 others that are currently being sent out for public comment. We also continue to monitor and provide feedback on all myriad of bills pending before the legislature, one of which that we're working with right now is the legislature. Some of them are seeking to make it mandatory that judges impose that mandatory supervision, so we would have to not be at our discretion, and we're working on that one. With the assistance of the Judicial Council, we really keep our fingers on the pulse of what's going on in the criminal law community, and we'll continue to do that. I want to just say that I have invaluably been helped by Shelley Curran, Arturo Castro, and Sharon Riley. They're exceptional. They are tireless. And though not specifically under the auspices of the Criminal Law Committee, I do want to add that Judge Cousins and I have been involved, as the Chief mentioned, in numerous judicial efforts to bring realignment and teach multiple justice partners on this new area of the law. Realignment law is taught at the Judicial College annually. It's taught at the Criminal Law Institute. It's been taught at, we've taught it at California Judges Association meetings, appellate courts institutes, Rudder Institutes, MCLE courses, state bar meetings, and to presentations in the individual states, counties. And in teaching, we are not just teaching judges. We're teaching also prosecutors, defense attorneys, clerks, people and members of the Board of Supervisors, county executives, police officers, and sheriffs. We've written, Judge Cousins and I, a treaty entitled Felony Sentencing After Realignment. It's now 130 pages. It covers every aspect of this law statutorily and every case that's set down by the courts of appeal for however long they last at this point. And lest I leave you with the misimpression that Judge Cousins and I share equal in this work, I would be remiss if I don't say that he carries the major burden of that. He has really been a champion in this area, spent any number of hours on it. He believes in it, and his efforts have been tireless. He is a star in our judiciary, a champion of justice, and I am just lucky to have been able to work with him the last 15 years.
Morris Jacobson, how's our Office of Criminal Justice Services doing?
Okay, so Justice Bigelow has anticipated some of my comments, certainly in terms of the Criminal Law Advisory Committee.
So I'm speaking on behalf of Jim Fox and myself. Both. So if I say anything that where I misspeak, it's me, Jim Fox. Jim Fox and I both came to be in liaisons of the Office of Criminal Justice Services at the AOC by way of coming through the Criminal Law Advisory Committee. Jim was there, I think he's the longest standing member in history. He was there for 16 years. I was there for about 5 years, and then we came to the Judicial Council at the same time, and this was our liaison assignment for the AOC. Before the SEC report, what I would describe as wise minds in the AOC moved in the direction of consolidating various criminal-related tasks and assignments into a single office. They put Shelley Curran in charge. As Justice Bigelow mentioned, she's absolutely outstanding. We had a staff attorney to the Criminal Law Advisory Committee, Arturo Castro, who was assigned to this unit. He's well beyond extremely good. And so this is what was going on probably at the same time the SEC report, the audit was being conducted. So this office in the AOC now comprises several distinct units that work very well together. One is sort of the legal unit, which the most visible aspect of that is the Criminal Law Advisory Committee. As Justice Bigelow mentioned, this group, among other things, not only does it engage in rulemaking and forms, but reviews legislation. And this is a really critical aspect of what's going on in terms of the judicial branch participation and realignment. To borrow from Karen Panks, she used the phrase the tidal wave of realignment. One of the things that we've seen in the last 3 years along with this has been that many people in the legislature, not necessarily criminal law lifers, if you will, have thought to offer legislation. And we've seen a number of pieces of legislation that might dramatically interfere with our ability to conduct business in the absence of funding. So, for example, there have been two different efforts at requiring bail hearings or OR hearings for any person in a revocation situation. In Alameda County alone, that would have added about 10,000 potentially evidentiary hearings to our workload without any money accompanying the statute to pay for the time that we would have spent with that. Alternatively, in my own personal experience, I was the person who set up the parole revocation court in Alameda County and immediately began encountering certain types of problems. What's right there is the Office of Criminal Justice Services, which is available to provide help, to provide advice, and also to help begin forming legislative fixes for some of the problems that we're seeing every day in the trial courts. So the legal unit, as I said, covers forms, it covers rules of court, and it covers this review of legislation that is absolutely imperative. A second unit is the research unit, and this unit is focused on gathering data. And there's a lot of things that are expressed about realignment if you listen to people, if you have conversations with people. Some people are very enthusiastic about it and think it's the answer and be all and end all, and other people think it's doom is upon us. And what this research unit does is it's gathering statistics in a neutral way to give us an idea about whether we're reducing recidivism on the one hand, which is one of the key goals, but also whether we are continuing to protect public safety. And so this is a work in progress. The research unit has come up with data points. We've gotten almost every court in the state to begin complying with this. And then we're going to be able to get a look over a couple of years to see whether, as has been widely reported, low-level theft offenses have gone through the ceiling without... Where thieves are able to act with impunity, or whether, in fact, we are successful in these efforts to provide programmatic answers and reduce recidivism and turning people to lives that don't threaten our public safety. So that unit, which is headed by Francine Byrne, is, at this point, it looks to me like it's a very, very effective unit with very good statistics. There's also a unit that is in charge of programming, Michael Roosevelt in charge of that unit, providing seminars and educational programs in terms of realignment from the point of view of the courts. So we have a very, very good unit there. I'll just make this pitch. Kurt Childs asked me, called me up the other day and asked me not to, but I'm going to make the pitch anyway. It needs more resources. So Judge Jarre, I'm on record on that one.
Thanks, Morris. Rick Levianos, Collaborative Justice Courts.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I want to thank the Chief and Judge Jarre, members of the Council, for the honor of being able to speak to you today and also being chair of the Collaborative Courts Advisory Committee. And it's a particularly exciting time to be in that spot because the role is pretty exciting. The committee focuses, charge focuses on effective, efficient practices in collaborative courts and assisting local courts. And I don't know if everybody knows, but a little background. We have more than 350 collaborative justice courts statewide, and we have collaborative justice courts in all but two of our counties, and more than 200 collaborative justice courts to deal with criminal issues. Criminal cases. The cost-benefit study that we had done of the drug courts a while back shows that these courts reduce recidivism by about twofold and cost by about $11,000 per participant. Basically speaking, it is an evidence-based practice. It's something that's been researched, been studied, been proven to have results. And the cost savings come about by the reduction in recidivism. One time I was having a conversation with one of my colleagues that was saying, you know, great, you know, you got, it's a great thing you're doing all this stuff. But, you know, we just don't have the time to invest or to do more of it. And I looked back at him and said, you don't have the time not to, because the increase in recidivism when you don't do business that way winds up with more cases. So it's a long long-term savings. There is some other stuff we know from the research. These types of courts are not designed for anybody but high-risk, high-needs individuals. So they are should be designed and applied to individuals who present the highest risk and have the highest needs. So you're going to monitor them more closely, and you're going to link them, do the linkage to resources to try to make it more effective. So if you look at the criminal justice system case, and I like to look at it in two parts. There's the part of that case that goes from the arrest up until the sentence, which is the traditional system, and that's what the traditional system has been designed to do. It does well, it functions, and that's the role. Then once an individual is sentenced, they're usually placed on probation, community supervision, or parole. So now you have the second half of the case, which traditionally gets ignored, and that's, I think, where we get our bad results. So oftentimes people would look at collaborative courts and they would think of it somehow as being in competition with the traditional court system. There's no competition. It complements the traditional court system by making that probation, making that parole, making that community supervision more effective. So I like to think of it in those two different processes. And, you know, I've gone through that, talked to Judge Jacobson about it and his committee about it and looking at it that way and doing education about it and on that way. And I think it's a pretty good way of looking at it overall. Now, with realignment, that supervision angle just became much greater because now not only do we have probation, but now we have mandatory supervision, local community supervision, PRCS, and parole. All those are now coming to the court. So those are individuals, many of whom would have gone to a different system before realignment, that are now coming to the court. We thought realignment was going to happen when the bill first came down. It was pretty clear that it would have, and we thought that the collaborative justice courts had ability or way because the partnerships already exist in the collaborative courts. The collaborative courts always already have partnerships with probation. The courts that were doing parole reentry already had collaborative partnerships with parole, with all with treatment providers and with all the providers necessary for the resources. So what we look at it. The collaborative courts is kind of like the last stop before somebody winds up going back to prison to keep that from happening and make the community safer by addressing specific issues like mental health, drug dependence, antisocial thinking, and veterans issues. So we're using the collaborative courts in this way. The goal is that we can relieve the offenders that go to prison or jail, but also relieve the workload of the court. Because by being more effective in managing that population, we are reducing our future incoming and able to manage the court more effectively. Realignment is still a work in progress with all kinds of challenges. The way we look at it is our goal is to take the highest risk, highest needs cases that are failing or likely to fail and find ways to get better outcomes for them so that we use less prison days, less jail days, less court resources on it. So we look at our role as supporting the courts and partnering with the county to get what the courts need to make realignment work, and which kind of gives me the point where I want to wrap it up. And the one thing, it's been evidence-based, and the legislature has shown in multiple different forms, and the governor, the ability to invest in that model because that model has produced results. And the most recent example was that the taking of money from CDCR's treatment budget and dedicating it to increase the parole reentry courts because they saw the results. So we look at it as a way to actually increase the resources for the court and for the counties in dealing with the population.
Brian, from the presiding judge's perspective.
Thank you, Dick. Thank you for the opportunity to change seats and sit here. I want to tell you, from this point of view, you look much more august.
or July.
You may recall at a December meeting when I was sitting in one of those chairs, I reported on a liaison visit to Stanislaus County and what I've since been calling the Stanislaus conundrum. A great group of trial court judges working hard to do everything right with very limited resources, but frustrated by jail overcrowding. In their case, it's a decades-long problem, but by all accounts made worse by 109. And they tell the frustrating stories. I told them to you. The DV defendant sentenced to a bullet year in jail and back in front of the judge in 3 weeks, having been let out, and did another DV crime. Another DV are on a 52-week batteries program, didn't go to their classes, and the judge is wagging his finger, don't you know I'm going to send you to jail, and it gets scoffed at because, I'll be out. And other courts have told us where the defense attorneys openly say to their clients, take the deal, don't worry about the jail. If you take this deal, you'll be home tonight before the judge is. That undermines, obviously, public safety. It undermines judges' sense of their own purpose and their morale. And is frustrating to everybody involved in what we do for a living. So TCP, Jack, decided to begin a discussion on this, not just about 109, but broaden it to the issue of jail overcrowding. What is the judge's role in dealing with jail overcrowding? So at the annual meeting January 30th of this year with SEAC and TCP, Jack, judges, we had a very interesting program, and an earlier speaker mentioned this, on the Affordable Care Act and the criminal jail population. We had a great handout full of materials. The point being that a lot of the people are in jail because you can't find a bed for them. You don't want to release them out to the public. Well, gee, now they have insurance. Whether it's a substance abuser and you can't get them into your local treatment program, now they've got insurance. So we talked to judges and the CEOs about that. And then the next day, we went with just a trial court presiding judges and had a panel on what is the judge's role in jail overcrowding. And there were wide views on this. In fairness, some very, very good judges, very high-minded judges said, look, our job is to impose the right sentence under the law and the facts, and then it's up to the jailer what happens after that. Others said, well, split sentencing is a nice idea, but I don't have confidence in the public safety aspect of it because in some cases, my probation department is so underfunded, they're stacking the cases and they can't give the time and attention to the defendants, and so I don't feel I can release them. And one judge even pointed out, it was David Wesley, PJ of LA, read to us from Marcy's Law, which if you don't mind, I'll read to you from Section 28, subparagraph F, sub 5. This is the Constitution of the United States, and it says, truth in sentencing. Sentences that are individually imposed upon convicted criminal wrongdoers based upon the facts and circumstances surrounding their cases shall be carried out in compliance with the court's sentencing orders and shall not be substantially diminished by early release policies intended to alleviate overcrowding in custodial facilities. It goes on to say, the legislative branch shall ensure sufficient funding to adequately house inmates for the full terms of their sentences. That's the Constitution. So, I thought that was interesting. Anyway, but several trial courts have sought participation in the problem, and I think you'll hear from some of them later. So in the same discussion, Brian Beck from Ventura stood up and told us about what they're trying to do with it. Alameda County, Morris Jacobson could tell you more about this and how they're trying to grapple with having part of this by having one judge do all the revocation sentencing so an experienced judge will give consistent sentences, and that can only help with the jail overcrowding issue. And in our county, where we're having the Sheriff's Department and PO join and train our judges so they feel more trusting in how well the defendants are being handled if they are released, so that our split sentencing numbers have gone up and up and up as we build that confidence. Also, with the reentry folks, in our county, we have a reentry court for parolees where we see them in court even before they've committed a crime. They want to come. They need the help. We give them the help. We introduce them to services. And then we expect our involvement as PJs will be ongoing. Of course, all of us are having our visits from the governor. Linda Penner made a reference to that. And as she mentioned, we had one in Santa Clara County. The governor, of course, wanted it in a closed room where it could be more candid. What a quaint idea, actually. But I digress. I understand. And it was a great meeting, and I've talked to the other PJs who had those meetings, and they've really, really been a valuable discussion. And then, as we're in Sacramento talking about trial court funding and promoting the chief's advocacy, we're getting some pushback from legislators and people in the governor's office. Well, what about the court's role in 109 funding? Is there something that the courts would be or could do with some of that 109 money? Not any part of the $612 million, but some of the 109 money. And we're carefully and cautiously at least entertaining discussions on that, and I have talked to some courts that maybe there are some things with another kind of money we could get case managers in the court. We could get some to our own treatment and therapy folks. But in sum, I would want to say that I think it is a fair description of the view of TCP, Jack, that though the trial court presiding judges can't solve the problem of jail overcrowding, we can and we want to be an important part of the conversation. Thank you.
Are there any questions from the council as to this panel? Yes.
I just had a question about the collaborative courts. Some of the things we've heard is that some of them are being cut back because of budget constraints. How's that affected this area?
Well, at least in terms of the ones that are funded through the drug court funding, that there hasn't been a cutback on the drug court funding ones. The parole reentry dollars that were out there and grant and funding, most of the actual courts have been funded through the grant funding process, and that process really hasn't diminished. Individual courts do it differently, and they have their own budget issues, so individual courts may be dealing with it separately out there. On the committee, though, the funds are pretty good in terms of coming in. Like I said earlier, it's something that grants and governors and legislatures at least appear in the current time to be willing to invest in, so it's a way of getting dollars to allow the processing of the cases. But I can't speak to, you know, every court, and I know every court has to go through its own decisions of how it's going to deal with budgetary issues. So I don't know about that.
Marianne?
So I know I'm not sure who can answer this question, but, you know, we've talked about the funding and how the jails and the sheriffs are going to get $100 billion or $1 billion, $500 and $500. Probation's getting a certain chunk. You know, the counties are getting a certain chunk, and I'm looking at the trickle-down effect and just know from the experience of my own county that really I think the courts are getting the smallest amount of any amount of money that's coming in, and yet we're the ones that are having all the court hearings, and we have the staff and have to kind of process these things. Certainly we're not housing them, but the whole process is being, you know, gone through the courts before it even gets to probation or gets to the jails for the sentence. So it does take time and staff and money for us to be able to do that. And so is there any discussion with the PJs or the Crim Law Committee or anybody else about, you know, increasing from the 109 money for the courts?
Well, of course, there is a pot of money already, and we have a distribution method. David Wesley, David Yamasaki are part of that. But there's no question that we could do more for jail overcrowding and do more to implement the spirit and purpose of 109 if we had more money. And I'm not talking about the woeful underfunding in part in our operations, but specifically under 109, yeah, I don't think there's any question about it. And I've talked to judges about this. We don't want to undermine our advocacy in Sacramento, and we don't want someone to say, well, oh, 109 money, great, we'll just earmark that in your budget when we give you your operations money. That would be wrong. But we can be part of the same solution that the probation department, the sheriff's department, and everybody else is a part of. I think we can be part of that 109 solution with 109 funds, and not large amounts, not the 100 millions kinds, but with discrete amounts, I think we can do better and do more for it.
I'll just piggyback on that very briefly. I don't know about other counties. You mentioned Contra Costa. Alameda County has been woefully unsuccessful in getting any piece of the 109 money pie. It is unbelievable in my view. We made a request 2 years ago for $150,000 for case managers for this revocation court. We didn't get a penny. The Sheriff's Department got 22 of the $35 million that was given to our county. We got nothing. We got nothing this year on our request as well. So the Community Corrections Partnership that divides up that money, it's difficult for us as courts to be very deeply involved in that for some of the same reasons that we've talked about with the open meetings rules. We have ethical concerns about getting involved in a discussion about dividing the pie of the money and with people who are going to appear in front of us. So there are issues there, but we are certainly, in my limited experience, my county only, we're not getting our share, and we have specific articulable needs where we could do more. No question.
I would add to that also the Crim Law Advisory Committee has a constant refrain, which is there's not enough money to take care of all the courts that they want us to have on PRCS and taking over parole. It's very expensive, and it's
every time a bill comes through, we want to accommodate the legislature, but a lot of times the members will say, we simply cannot afford this.
So the court is giving these services in kind, basically.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. I'll end it on that note, please, and we'll bring the next group in. Obviously, we as a system are facing a lot of challenges, but we'd like to end on a positive note in the sense that we've identified three courts that have really risen to those challenges and have created some very active, aggressive programs to deal with this new population. So we have with us Brian Back, who will talk about Ventura's pretrial release program, John Kennedy from Contra Costa, who will talk about split sentences, and then Judge Desiree Bruce Lyle from San Diego regarding the mandatory supervision court. So let's start in kind of chronological order. Brian, talk about Ventura.
Okay. Thank you, Chief and Judge Jarr and honorable members for having all of us here and listening to us. And having used the word honorable, I have to disclose that I do know some of the members in a little bit greater depth. They might be named Jim or Dean or Brian or the other Brian. And I say that because knowing them as I do, there's a distinct possibility that they could find themselves accused of a non-prison eligible 1170H crime at some time. If they are coming through Ventura County, good for them.
Now, there's more than one Jim on the council. So I'm feeling safe.
There's only one that just spoke up.
I don't know the man.
Listening to all of what, you know, some of us knew a lot about and some of us didn't, the program I'm going to tell you about didn't need realignment to create. It needed us thinking more like judges and being collaborative with our partners and coming up with our best efforts here. And what we have is a pretrial assessment program. It's not that far outside the box. It's just sitting down and really thinking about it. The information you have there, the way it works is as follows. And this all came from the CCP. The CCP in our county, 900,000 people, 29 judges. We're too short right now. They wanted to address what the reality is, 20% of our jail population are post-release and parolees. As with most counties, roughly 60% of the jail population is pre-trial. Not an population issue, not a counter-constitutional issue, but who belongs in jail issue is what this addresses. So what happens is, on the non-prison eligible 1170H cases that are coming before Department 13, they're all coming before one department. The night before, the district attorney gets a list of all those people who are going to come on the next day. They look at the list, they determine eligibility, they email the list to two dedicated probation officers who look at it further to make sure there's eligibility. The next morning, when that person comes on for arraignment, this is very first appearance arraignment. The deputy has worked up the bail schedule for the judge, so the judge has that. And as we all know, we are annually required to re-up on that bail schedule. So bail is a requirement that we all have. But typically, all we have had in the past is bail. And does bail ever get adjusted? Yeah, it gets adjusted up. Here's your bail, $5,000 added for a misdemeanor probation, $10,000 for a felony probation, whatever it is. It rarely gets adjusted down. You get a typical bail increase, but not too many bail decrease motions. So this list goes to the probation officers. The probation officer plucks that defendant out of court in the morning, conducts a 45-minute face-to-face interview, and then goes through the Ohio Risk Assessment, it's the Ohio Risk Assessment Pretrial Assessment Tool, and there's, I think, a copy of it in your program. It's a very simple question and answer tool, combined obviously with the 45-minute interview and combined with what else we know about the person. The probation officer then generates a report, emails it to the district attorney, the public defender, and that case comes on at 1:30 in the afternoon. I mean, it moves quickly. And at 1:30, when that case comes on before the judge, the judge then has the ability of both the DA and the PD to argue with regard to what the release situation should be. Should there be bail, or should there be released OR, or should there be released OR with conditions? The typical conditions are what we think they might be. If you got a drug problem, this person is going to be required to report for testing. They may be required to just check in with probation. Some of them will be released straight OR. The judge then makes the call. The attorneys have the opportunity to argue it, but the judge makes the call. And what we have, as in most of these programs, is the pudding, and that's where the proof is. So the information I think you have in front of you, which is the six-month review, we just rolled this out on September 30th of last year. It takes a while to get these things rolled out, and it, among other things, for a judge who's not quite comfortable with doing things this way until he or she sees it done a couple of times and sees that it might work. So when I say the proof's in the pudding, I hope that information is in there. Since September 30th, ending March 30th, 241 defendants were reviewed. 45% of them were deemed low risk or moderate risk, and there was a recommendation that they be released OR 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 with terms. The numbers are, in this six-month period, 110 people were released with OR terms or just straight OR. Here's the proof in the pudding. 94.5% of those appeared in court as directed. 94.5% of those remained arrest-free. 87% tested negative for controlled substances and alcohol and reported to probation as directed. 77% appeared in court as directed, remained arrest-free, tested negative for controlled substances and alcohol, and reported to probation as directed. Now, some of these, those are good figures. Those are really good figures. Some of the interesting figures, is that printout in your packet, I hope? Because the figures under that show when the judge didn't have a recommendation for release, but because of the information that received, he still felt compelled to release the person OR 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 with terms. And you'll see the numbers there. Instead of 94.5 appearing in court as directed, it's 89% appeared as directed. That's still a pretty good number. But when you see 94.5%, is that a good number? Yes. And some of the things that some of those non-appearances in court were explained afterwards. It wasn't always that the guy or the gal just failed to show up because they were blowing us off. There were reasons why in some cases. So what we have found is because of the numbers, and if you let me back up, although the numbers are just a little bit reduced when the judge makes the call, even when the probation has not recommended it, that to me suggests what we all know, or at least we're learning about these evidence-based practices. It's tough sometimes, but you have to have fidelity to the objective instruments. And anybody who has been in juvenile court or juvenile law for the last 12, 15 years know this is old hat, because this is what we've been doing in juvie for years. If you remain dedicated to the instrument, in this case I'm talking about the pretrial assessment instrument, you're in pretty good shape for making your decisions informed by that information. So that's what we have. I could go into a lot more detail, but I really don't need to. It's a very simple program that we're seeing works. And everything that you've got in your packet, I keep saying I hope it's in your packet.
It is in the packet.
You got the whole kit and caboodle. If you want to sit down with a collaborative group in your county tomorrow, you can adopt this program, give it a ride, and see how it works.
Thank you, Brian. John Kennedy, how did the sentencing process work out?
Good morning. I'm going to talk about split sentences because that's our topic from Contra Costa County, the experience we've had in that. And as Justice Bigelow explained to us this morning, the split sentence applies when a defendant's eligible for a county jail sentence, not a state prison sentence. The judge has the option of sending the defendant to serve the entire time in county jail or to divide it between county jail and mandatory supervision. These are for nonviolent, non-serious, and non-sexual offender cases. So when the realignment first came about in Contra Costa County, we gathered our experienced criminal judges, including Judge O'Malley, and got our arms around the law and said, we got to get ahead of this curve. So we educated our judges, sat down with our DAs, PDs, and other justice partners, probation, and sheriff's department, and worked together to recommend some steps to implement this correctly. From a judge's perspective, we look at the split sentencing option, and this is how it plays out in real terms, to put it as concretely as I can. Once I've concluded a sentence for a defendant, let's, for example, say it's a five-year sentence with all enhancements and everything, I can send the defendant to county jail for 5 years. He'll, as a practical matter, serve 2.5 years, walk out the door, have zero supervision, zero services, no drug testing, no search and seizure, walks out the door with nothing. The second option, and that's after 2.5 years of the 5-year sentence. The second option is I could split the sentence with 3 years in county jail and 2 years of mandatory supervision. So the defendant then serves 1.5 years of the 3-year jail sentence, but then he has 2 years of supervision. So he's released, required to report to probation. Our probation officer is visiting him in the jail before he releases, just to make sure he knows they're going to be watching and waiting. And then once the defendant gets out, he or she gets services, gets tested for drugs, drug treatment, search and seizure requirements if imposed by the judge, and job training, housing, mental health, whatever they need to the extent our services and budgets permit. But the important thing is that that person is then in jail for 1.5 years plus 2 years of supervised release. The total time we have some control over the defendant is 3.5 years rather than the 2.5 years of a straight jail sentence. And again, if you divide it 2 years county jail and 3 years of supervision, then you have a total of 4 years of actual effect on the defendant in an effort to reduce recidivism. So the swing can be in a 5-year sentence from 2.5 years in county jail, nothing further, to 4 years of jail and supervision. So our conclusion when we realized the ramifications of this was that we would prefer the supervision. So we, again, met with our DAs and PDs and all in our probation office and encouraged split sentences. As we all know, the vast majority of criminal cases are resolved by a plea agreement, and our DAs and PDs have reached plea agreements in very many of our cases that include split sentences. As a result, since October 1st, 2011, 81% of every case sentenced under 1170H has been a split sentence in our county. Now, we didn't set out to be extraordinary, but that turns out to be far higher than the state average. So one of the benefits, obviously, is it reduces our county jail population. So it helps with our bouncing against the ceiling on our capacity. Now, the real question, of course, is whether it does so at the expense of public safety. So we have been tracking that stat since we started with this on October 1st, and we find that 26% of those on mandatory supervision are failures in the sense of either they have absconded supervision or have committed 2 new crimes while under mandatory supervision. And that compares favorably with the parole revocation rate. So we don't believe that the cost in reduced jail time has resulted in less community safety. We think it has helped recidivism by having supervision rather than straight jail and release into the community. So I think it's early to say, obviously, but we're pretty comfortable that the choice of has been a successful one for us.
Thank you. So finally, we're now going to talk to the post-release folks, people who have done their time and they're out. Desiree Bruce Lyle is the judge who supervises most of the post-release folks, but we've asked her to specialize, focus her comments on the mandatory supervision group and the mandatory supervision court that she runs, which is very intriguing. Desiree?
Thank you very much. Chief and honorable members, thank you for the opportunity to address your council today. I've been told I get wound up when I talk about the subject. I don't have enough time here to get wound up, I don't think, so I'm going to get straight to business. San Diego has one of the 5 original parolee reentry courts, and that was established about 3 years ago with funding from CalEMA grants. Now, with the advent of realignment, the funding source changed to AB 109 funds, and the court was renamed Reentry Court. Today, it serves parolees, PRCS, and mandatory supervision offenders who pick up new felony charges. Now, in 2012, a visionary sheriff, William Gore, established a reentry facility in San Diego. And the facility is designed to house offenders, male and female, with split sentences. And he rolled out a plethora of in-custody educational programs designed to mentally prepare the offenders for a seamless transition from custody into community supervision. The facility offers an impressive list of programming, including cognitive behavior therapy, substance abuse, GED, life skills, and other psychosocial and vocational classes. Now, the sheriff's approach inspired our San Diego presiding judge, David Danielson, to establish what we call an AB 109 post-judgment court. This court hears parole revocation, PRCS violations, mandatory supervision matters, and reentry court matters, and I preside over the court. Due to time limitations, I will limit my comments to mandatory supervision court. This court was engineered by Judge Danielson. It is a collaborative effort between the court, the Sheriff's Department, DA, PD, probation, and Health and Human Services Agency. It is a hands-on court, and it began operation in February 2013. As Ms. Bigelow said, mandatory supervision talks like probation, walks like probation, but it is not probation, and I'm hoping after I'm done talking, you'll recognize or realize why. We have pre-release hearings. 30 days prior to the release to mandatory supervision status, the offender appears at a pre-release hearing in my court. I make sure that there's a comprehensive case plan developed by probation. This is based on evidence-based risk and needs assessments. The plan is shared with all the parties prior to the hearing. And we have a pre-calendar meeting to discuss any issues relating to the reports prior to me taking the bench. I go over the plan with the offender in the court. We establish a release date, confirm conditions, programming, and requirements to make sure that the offender understands that he or she will be closely monitored while in the community by probation. So one of the distinct differences here with probation is the close monitoring. Upon release, the offender is fitted with a GPS for a minimum of 2 weeks. This is to ensure that curfews are followed, the offender assimilates into the community supervision. We also have status hearings. The offenders are evaluated on an ongoing basis to ensure the delivery of services are provided in a way that supports their case plan. The goal is to provide a step-down approach that is comprehensive and supports the efforts of the community programs and the probation officer. We employ incentives and sanctions. These are employed to reinforce the need for continued compliance. The frequency of review hearings for an offender is dependent on his or her level of compliance and progress in the community. We also have revocation hearings on mandatory supervision. Mandatory supervision violations are heard by the court, and the offenders are sanctioned accordingly, including revoking their mandatory supervision and remanding them to serve the remainder of their mandatory supervision time in custody. So far, I have seen more than 350 offenders transition into the community. Our calendar operates one day per week with about 40 to 60 matters on calendar, and it continues to grow. What lessons have we learned? Each person has his or her own risks and needs, and they should be addressed with an individualized plan. Fairness must be balanced with individual needs. We've also learned that there is no one-size-fits-all policy or law that will fix recidivism. What challenges and limitations have we encountered? Well, the fact that most offenders are resistant to treatment or any type of structure while on mandatory supervision in the community is a challenge, and it is very troubling. It is very important for us to incentivize offenders to engage in rehabilitation. Right now, it is too easy for an offender to opt to do their time as opposed to community supervision. And even though we call it mandatory supervision, and you've heard some of the speakers say they can't opt to do their time, they find a way around it. Custody credits motivate them to want to do their time as opposed to engage in rehabilitation. So rehabilitation becomes a hard sell from the court's perspective when the other option is a shorter custody time with no supervision at the conclusion of the custody time. It takes a good 6 months for the fog to lift and for the offender to engage in the process of changing their lives. But without the hammer of a jail term, there's no motivation to continue to engage and break the recidivism cycle. For example, an and mandatory supervision offender serving 18 months of community supervision from a three-year term recognizes very early about the six-month point that in the community, life could be, after about 6 months in the community, they recognized life could be a lot easier back in custody, where he or she would only have to serve 6 months of the remaining 12 months, get out with no supervision. And what we find then is that there's no motivation to continue. The motivation shuts down. They violate. They get a revocation, and they get a reward because they get a shorter time to serve in custody. We should consider incentivizing good behavior and punishing bad behavior. A change would also encourage more judges to impose split sentences with the knowledge that there's a safety net to protect our communities if the offender fails to adhere to community supervision conditions. The use of split sentencing, as you've heard already today, has varied from county to county, branch to branch, and even courtroom to courtroom. It would be extremely helpful to have a rule of court creating a sentencing structure that embeds needs assessments into the sentence. And it was music to my ears to hear Justice Bigelow indicate that the Criminal Law Advisory Committee is looking at that very issue, so I will not belabor that point. Mental health treatment is another challenge for us. Offenders with mental health treatment present a very, very extremely problematic challenge. It's difficult to find appropriate facilities to house and treat those offenders, but that is in and of itself a presentation by itself. While it's too early for data to establish certain trends, early unofficial indications that I have observed that recidivism in the mandatory supervision population is much lower than that of probationers and PRCS offenders. I can comfortably state that we are changing minds, changing lives, and making our communities safer. We have a lot of work ahead of us, but we are on the right track. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. If I can be of any further assistance to continue this dialogue, I would be more than honored to participate. Thank you.
Thank you, Desiree. I think that rumble I'm hearing are probably stomachs waiting for lunch, but maybe if there are any one or two questions I can take of this panel, we'll certainly permit that. Any questions? David.
Are you seeing the attitudes between defense counsel and prosecutors morphing? In the beginning, it seemed like prosecutors wanted straight time and defense counsel wanted splits. And are you seeing that changing?
Is that directed to me?
Anyone.
I can answer that from San Diego's perspective. DA's district attorney's a champion of mandatory supervision, and they've been educating all the DAs in that office, and so they're very open to the concept.
Yeah, it really looks at many levels like this varies tremendously right now, county by county, depending on the DA's attitude, depending on the sheriff's attitude, and the court participation.
Any other questions? Yes.
This is for, sorry, Judge Bruce Lyle. Do you tailor the programs to the services that your probation department has access to?
Yes.
What do you do if they need services that you, like you said, mental health services are limited?
We actually have, and that's why I said it was a whole separate presentation in and of itself. We have a lot of community-based organizations that provide mental health treatment, and probation has pulled them into the fold, and we rely on them for those kinds of services. But yes, we're always at some point or another, depending on the needs of the offender, limited in what we can provide. But we're very lucky in San Diego that we have in existence a huge collaborative effort, and it's always been in San Diego, and it's very helpful.
Brian,
just,
comment.
Just one comment. We have all seen mental health issues being really challenging for us over the years. Starting July 1 last year when we got parole revocation hearings, you can step up the mental health issues more than a couple of steps. We're seeing people I mean, you know, we haven't had to resort to many LPS pathways with most of the people we see, but we're starting to see it now, and you're seeing all of the agencies impacted, human services, public health, everybody's being impacted. We're getting significantly greater mental health problems with the parolees we're receiving.
Well, as you can see, lots of challenges, but I think there's lots of good things going on. This is definitely a work in progress, but I hope this presentation has given you at least a context for some of the things that you're going to be getting from us, from the committees and so forth, and various programs. We very much appreciate the time that you have spent with us. Chief Justice, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was really fascinating. Thank you very much. We look forward to recommendations and proposals as we move ahead.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dick, for all the work you do. You're teaching us.
Thank you.